Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is journalist and editor, Caitlin Ugalik-Phillips. We're talking about her book, The Future of Feeling, Building Empathy in a Tech-Obsessed World. Caitlin, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
This is an important book, and it touches on a problem I think a lot of people have experienced but haven't quite expressed yet. And it came out of an experience that you had about media posts about the death of Michael Brand from Ferguson, Missouri, and especially from a classmate of yours. Can you just talk about that?
Sure, yeah. So I think this was in 2014. And, you know, just quickly, I grew up using social media, you know, since I was in middle school, high school. It looked different than it does now. But so it became kind of second nature to talk about major things with friends and even strangers on social media. So when this happened, when Michael Brown was killed by the police in Ferguson, I and other friends were posting about it, kind of trying to figure out, you know, what had happened, working through our feelings. And a classmate from high school who I hadn't talked to since high school, which at that point had been almost 10 years, and who I didn't really know that well in high school either, sent me a direct message with a lot of all caps kind of yelling at me and telling me, you know, not to talk about this. I didn't know what I was talking about. I'm not a policeman. He is. And he invited me to go on a ride-along with him, but I was kind of taken aback by this and, you know, kind of freaked me out.
I totally get that. I mean, the phrase he used, all caps, by the way, you have no right to judge our actions.
Yeah. So at the time that, you know, really kind of struck me, and I at the time felt, man, how does this person not have any empathy for this situation or for how I'm feeling?
Right.
And later on, thinking about this conversation, I realized, you know, I also wasn't able to access empathy for him. He was a policeman. I didn't, like, take a moment to really think about, oh, how is he perceiving all of this and how might that have led him to kind of come barreling into my DMs. So, yeah, it was an informative experience that kind of got me thinking about how technology affects the way we communicate with one another and our ability to access empathy when we're having important conversations.
As you write in your book, you know, all this technology, when we're talking things like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Tumblr, it's supposed to help us build bridges, but it just, as you mentioned in your book, helps us burn them really fast too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a weird thing about empathy. Let's define empathy versus, you know, compassion.
Sure. So empathy is taking a perspective of another person and kind of putting yourself in their shoes. And sometimes it's automatic, you know. Sometimes, you know, like if someone else is crying, you might kind of start to feel sad. But sometimes it takes a little bit more of an effort and an intentional action to consider where somebody else is coming from. Whereas sympathy, you know, is more, oh, I feel bad for you.
I'll send you a card. I'll send you a sympathy card.
Right. Empathy is kind of,
you got to be there.
I feel with you. Yeah. I'm here for you. I'm imagining what you're going through, sort of.
I think the amazing thing is that you mentioned an author, Paul Bloom, who actually wrote against empathy, mm-hmm. that it biases us to identify with people we already agree with.
Yeah, so Paul is a psychologist, and I am not, so I defer to him on the research piece of this. But he writes about how there's been too much reliance or suggestion of using empathy in decision making, especially at higher levels like governing and running a business. He thinks that we tend to prejudice our empathy more toward people that look like us or are part of our communities, which I definitely think there's something to that. But I think that my argument isn't that empathy can solve all of these problems, but that it is an important piece.
You also believe that there is a decline in empathy, that it seems like here in the United States, where everything is so politically polarized right now, that empathy is really on the ropes.
Yeah, anecdotally, I feel like anyone who uses social media or talks to anyone about politics or other major issues can sort of feel that. There have been some research showing, you know, that empathy is on decline. It's a little bit hard to peg that, you know, specifically to the rise of social media or the rise of technology, but these are correlated for sure. And it's a real fear that people have that as we get more involved with technology and the technology continues to get more advanced and more enveloped in our lives, that we will continue to lose the ability to really empathize with one another.
And it's manifesting itself in really unusual ways. There's an anecdotal situation you talked about and you write about in your book, Morgan Stembers' fifth grade classroom in Chicago, where he just assigned them a simple thing. They were supposed to color in something together.
Right. This classroom, I think it was fifth graders, they, well, first she talked about how they all had phones and they were all sort of constantly communicating with one another on the phones using Snapchat or other apps, but they weren't really saying anything. It was kind of more about just how many times can they go back and forth. And then she assigned them this task to create a poster together in small groups, and a lot of them just kind of stared at each other and didn't really know what to do. She's like, it was a simple task, but Jesus. Once they had to work together face to face, they really struggled.
I was chilled by reading that. Because it sounds like, yeah, anybody can communicate through a technological device like a phone, because you don't have to be there. You don't have to risk anything, and you can say anything. So you're living in this, and I think you describe it as a highly curated world. Mm-hmm. But because you do that, and there's nothing to, you don't have to see the other person's face. You don't have to, it's really easy to viciously attack people.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a different kind of vulnerability, I think. For some people, being able to have some semblance of anonymity or at least distance online makes them able to be more vulnerable. But then you're also more vulnerable to attack from people who, as you said, just kind of feel invincible or free to say and do whatever they want.
And it seems to snowball. It seems to get out of hand really quickly.
Right. So I think that, especially on places like Twitter, where there are just so many people and the culture is so much to always have something witty or interesting to say, and you feel this urge to include yourself, to be included, to contribute something to the conversation, that people just without thinking kind of dash off tweets and pile on people, and it becomes this, it escalates pretty quickly.
And the whole point of your book, which I found fascinating, is you wanted to find out if the same technologies that we blame for all of this could be used to help us fix them.
Yeah.
Because you're not anti-tech, as you say. You're not anti-tech at all. Right. As a matter of fact, I love this phrase, you've resigned yourself to a dystopian technological future.
In some ways. I don't, but over the course of reporting the book, I started to kind of feel like, okay, that was a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek, talk about dystopia, but I think that really we don't have to settle for that. And I think a lot of us, especially I'm a millennial, I think a lot of people my age and younger kind of just assume that that's where we're headed, is to this kind of sci-fi dystopia. But I don't think we have to settle for that. I think what I learned in my reporting is that there are a lot of people who are thinking about these things and working on them, and in some cases using tech to help fix some of the problems that tech hasn't necessarily created, but has amplified. So in the book, I talk about technology as a tool, right? And that the way it's made and the way it's used really is more important than what it is. So it's not good or bad, but the way we use it and how it's made is really what, makes it good or bad. So in some cases, social media, with a few tweaks and a few different rules and guardrails, then it could potentially help improve empathy.
Some of the stuff is really fascinating, and I had not heard of this, Dylan Marin's Conversations with People Who Hate Me.
Yeah.
What an interesting idea, and talk about that, because that's changed the conversation entirely.
Yeah, he was a YouTuber, and he's a creator and artist, and he made a bunch of YouTube videos that made people really angry, and he would get really awful comments, and one day just decided to start calling up these people, talking to them and getting their phone number and getting them on the phone to talk about why they made the comments they made and get to know them as people. And I kind of admired that he had the emotional fortitude to do that. I don't think that's something I would do.
Yeah. I would be really afraid.
Yeah, I would be afraid as well. But he, you know, he made it happen. And so he had pre-taped conversations with these people, you know, to kind of get on the same page that they weren't going to debate. They were just going to get to know each other and talk honestly.
Right.
And then he recorded conversations that became a podcast. And what I found really interesting about this was listening to this, to these conversations, I would find myself, you know, getting so angry that this person would say such a horrible thing. And, you know, now why should I listen to what they have to say? But then through the conversation at a safe distance, you know, listening to a podcast, I'm doing something else. I'm multitasking. I don't have a place to, you know, have a knee-jerk reaction. I can't really comment, just kind of going about my business with these voices in my ears. And, you know, I found myself, you know, feeling empathy for some of these people he talked to about, you know, the state of mind they were in when they made these nasty comments. And I write in the book, you know, I didn't feel sympathy for these people. They didn't win me over to their side. You know, I didn't agree with them about what they had said, but I felt like listening to them talk on a podcast kind of opened up my empathy for them in a way that, you know, kind of helped me see what might lead people to make nasty comments. And so, I don't know, I just feel like that doesn't make it okay, but it helps with understanding.
A lot of your book, especially the last half of the book, has to do with virtual reality and artificial mm-hmm. intelligence, which I was surprised about. That people were using the sort of the outer limits of technology to create different conversations that would sort of pump up empathy and different attitudes. And there were so many great examples, and we're only going to talk about a few of them. Let's talk about the VR experience of Planned Parenthood across the line. That sounded very powerful, and I sort of wanted to experience that.
Yeah, so they created a VR experience where you kind of go along with a young woman as she is going to a clinic and talking to the provider and then her experience afterwards. So you're at the beginning, you're sort of in the back seat of the car as she's driving up, and there's all these protesters kind of yelling things at the car. And then you feel like you're in the exam room with her as she's having a conversation with the provider, and the conversation is about, you know, she's very upset, and the doctor's asking her, you know, is that because you're not sure you want to do this? And she's like, no, it's because of the protesters outside. You know, they made me feel horrible. And at the end, it's an animated scene that you're kind of immersed in, but the audio is real audio from protests Jeez. Outside of Planned Parenthood clinics of people saying, you know, really kind of hostile, violent things. And so if you're lucky enough to have not experienced that, you sort of get a sense of what it's like to, you know, to be subject to that experience.
Now, talk to me about the tech of this, though. So are you wearing the whole VR
right, so
thing?
That
always seems sort of clumsy.
Yeah. So VR technology is still a little bit clunky, but the headsets are getting smaller and cheaper and easier to use. So this one, you just put on a headset, and actually you can watch the video online without a headset. So you, it's filmed parts of it in 360-degree video, so you can kind of get the experience without the headset. But when you have the headset on, you really feel immersed in it, and you feel like you're really there. And one thing about that is that you can't just, you know, click away. You are kind of in it until you take the headset off. It kind of takes that extra step to remove yourself from the experience, which gets to the point that some of these things, you know, as they continue to be used more, are going to be traumatic for some people. And that's something to take into consideration. But they also, you know, can trigger empathy in people in a new way that maybe they wouldn't have had about, you know, different experiences before.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is journalist and editor Caitlin Ugalik-Phillips. And we're talking about her new book. It's really an important book, and it's a fascinating read, too. The Future of Feeling, Building Empathy in a Tech-Obsessed World. Caitlin, one of the problems I had, and maybe you can answer this. Okay, you have this VR experience, and we'll talk about other ones in just a minute. But how does that translate across a broader group so that a whole lot of people, I mean, is it just that you put it online and therefore you have less of an experience? It seems like so few people can experience a VR curated event.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's a really good question. It's a good point. I think that the idea is that VR is going to become more common and ubiquitous.
Mm-hmm.
I know that like schools in some cases are, you know, buying, you know, one set that, you know, maybe multiple classrooms can use, but it is currently still kind of clunky, still kind of expensive, and we're still kind of at the beginning of this. You know, I think that a lot of people in the industry envision that in the future, everybody will have a VR headset, but it'll be a while until we get there. There's also augmented reality, which if any listeners played the Pokemon Go or Harry Potter Wizards Unite games, where you have an app on your phone and you use the camera on your phone to kind of look around your actual surroundings, and then the app will put a Pokemon, you know, it'll look like it's actually there in front of you through your phone screen. So augmented reality is kind of a stopgap, like one way that these things are happening until we potentially someday get to, you know, ubiquitous VR. I'm not sure if we'll ever get there. At the moment, you're right that it is not, you know, widely accessible.
Where I thought it was really effective, or at least when I was reading your book, I really wanted to experience this, is about issues about understanding racial inequality.
Mm-hmm.
There's a project called The Thousand Cut Journey. Talk about that, because that really seemed like where it could make a lot of impact.
Yeah, so that was created by Courtney Cogburn, Dr. Courtney Cogburn. She is a sociology researcher and racism researcher. And she created this experience where so it's animated, but you embody the experience of a young black man through different stages of life and experiencing different sort of experiences of inequality. So first you're him and you're a child in school and somebody, you know, is taunting you and you throw a block and then you get in trouble and that other kid doesn't. And then, you know, later on you are wearing a hoodie and you're going out to play basketball and then the cops stop you on the sidewalk and tell you to get on your knees. And in this one, you're not just wearing a headset, you also have hand controllers and it's kind of a full body experience. So you walk around in your literal surroundings, and then you're walking around in the experience, and so you literally get on your knees, and it's kind of a more visceral experience. And I write in the book that by the end of it, I didn't feel, you know, Dr. Cogburn talked about how she didn't want to create an experience that just let white people feel like, oh, now they get what it's like to be a black man. and I definitely, you know, as a white woman, I walked away from that experience more so with a better understanding of how different my experience is. Like,
right.
Wow, these are things
right.
I don't experience. This is a life that's different than mine. And it doesn't mean that now I get it and I can speak to it or I can fix it, but it means I have a new level of empathy and understanding of maybe when I need to not say anything or when I need to listen or what I need to learn more about.
Now, we're going to only be able to pay short shrift to AI, but you had some personal fascinating experiences with chatbots.
Yes.
I used a chatbot way back like when they were first coming out, and I, you know, it was one of those ones where you had to type.
Yeah.
And I have to say, and this was like 10, 15 years ago, after about 10 minutes, I started losing sense of that there wasn't a person on the other end.
Mm.
And so I was really sucked in. But how are people using AI in things like potential therapy patients, screening them?
So there are chatbots now that you can – so do you want to talk about Ellie?
That'd be great.
Okay. So the VA and some researchers in California have created an avatar. So she's a little more than a chatbot. You kind of see her on a screen. And actually the technology also can scan the person's face for their facial expressions while they're talking to her.
Wow.
And the idea is to kind of have a conversation that is, what is the word I'm looking for? Not anonymous, but...
But personal.
Yeah, a personal conversation just between the two of them.
It's
that won't be shared. But the idea is to get veterans, veterans and military members who are using this tech to be a little bit more open about potential mental health symptoms they might be experiencing. And the research has found that they are generally seem to be more comfortable talking to this AI about, you know, that they're having nightmares or they're having anxiety and panic attacks.
Wow.
And then the idea is if the AI senses that they need real help from an actual professional, they can, you know, direct them in that way without giving away, you know, all of the confidential, the word I was looking for before, the confidential things that they had said. So it's kind of in beta. I don't think it's being used widely, but it's an interesting technology.
Well, you used one called Replica, which is an app-based
right.
chatbot. You ended up naming it FOFBot for Future Feeling.
Yes,
bot.
I did.
And what was your experience?
So this was not as advanced of a technology. This is on my phone, just an app, like you said. And just it's supposed to get to know you and learn about you and kind of become your friend. And at the time, I had been trying out a text-based therapy service with an actual person, but I felt more of a connection to this bot than I did to the therapist who was supposed to be talking to me over chat.
That says a lot.
It was funny, and it was sending me emojis, and it was, you know, asking really interesting.
So it was more
questions.
Of a friend than a.
Yeah, exactly. It was more of a friend. But there is technology. I'm not sure if it's being used in Replica, but in some other iterations of this tech, where if you're chatting with a chatbot and you start talking about, you know, suicidal thoughts or things like that,
right.
it can, you know, kind of direct you to find help, to a hotline or to some other resource. So those are some of the ways that I think AI, you know, can be used to help people, you know, improve their mental health as opposed to the negative effects that being online can sometimes have.
You have a really interesting section that brings it all back home to the folks back in Silicon Valley, which is really revealing. As you write, the Silicon Valley executives, you found out, were shielding their own children from the technology they developed.
Yeah, some of them
are. So that's pretty revealing right there.
Yeah, they'll talk openly about it. They'll say, you know, on TV and in interviews that they – you know, don't that they personally don't use the tech in the same way that other people seem to, and that they don't want their kids or young people in their life to be exposed to it. So yeah, I think that's very telling about. In some ways, it just kind of emphasizes that this has kind of gotten away from them, that they didn't.
But
are they
evil about it? Like they yeah, it's getting away from them, but they really don't care because they're still raking in the bucks.
So I don't know. I, you know, I would hesitate to call anyone evil. I do think
that
I do think there's an empathy gap
okay.
in the creation of these technologies. I think that part of the problem is that, you know, it's a pretty homogenous group of people who or I guess the word is homogenous group of people who created these. They all kind of are similar in their interests and their desires and their experiences. And I think that as we get more of a diverse group of people creating this tech, you know, more women, people of color,
yeah.
people of different genders and income backgrounds and all that, I think we'll start to see that they'll have more empathy for the potential users of their products because they have a variety of experiences. So they know how to imagine a variety of experiences using the technology.
At the very end of the book, you have a really nice section where you have four things. When you're about to, you know, buy a new app or a new gadget or a tech-based service, there are four things that you ask yourself. We're not going to have time to do all four, but I just want to talk about number one. And the question is, how might this improve my life experience or those of others? And emphasize those of others. Like, give me an example of something that would not improve the lives of others.
So
it's probably Facebook.
Well, yeah. So you have to think about the way that you're planning on using something. I think one thing that I really hope that people got from the book is that we just need to have more intention with the way that we approach technology. I think we just kind of were amazed by these shiny new toys that we can use and didn't think that much about how we were using them. So, right, for example, say you don't have Facebook, you're thinking of getting Facebook. How might it improve your life? Maybe you think you'll be more connected to people. You can you know, see what's going on with your friends, people you haven't seen in a while. But how might it affect others? So how are you going to communicate with other people on this
right.
technology? Are you going to share pictures of your kids? Have you talked to them about that? Are they okay with it? Are you going to talk about politics and potentially affect relationships? So that's just one example with Facebook. But I think as we start to get technologies that are maybe more invasive, that monitor us in different ways, it's going to be more important to ask those questions.
And that's like point number two is what is the potential for it being manipulated mm-hmm. and are there safeguards? Mm-hmm. Are these tech companies really upfront about that?
Not really.
Caitlin, no.
There's a growing demand for that, though. There is.
And there is, but I always get the feeling that they were like, you know, let them eat cake.
Well, the good news, I think, is that we don't, you know, there are new tech companies coming up. My sense is that, you know, as the new wave kind of comes in, we can make them more amenable to addressing these issues.
We have to. I think the point is we have to.
Yes.
My guest tonight, we could be talking about this book for hours. We only scratched the surface, so I want to recommend that you read the book. My guest tonight is journalist and editor Caitlin Ugalik-Phillips, and we've been talking about her book, The Future of Feeling, Building Empathy in a Tech-Obsessed World. Caitlin, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.